Vanguard assemble. It's time for take two.
That's a very good joke. Very good.
Shall we start with Saint Omer?
Yes.
Or Saint Omer.
So this. So we were just discussing this before in the brief break while the ads happened. So the film title is written, if you said it, this is the Pano Raisin thing, if you said it as an English reader.
On which more later.
Saint Omer. The town is Saint Omer. But Saint Omer is how you would say it if you were kind of reading it. And it's not hyphenated. So the town is hyphenated, Saint Omer is hyphenated, but the title isn't. And both you and I were wondering whether the fact that it isn't hyphenated means that rather than just calling it Saint Omer, which is the place, there is a kind of an implication of something supernatural, something, which of course actually is part of the story. So this is the remarkable, and I use that word, you know, advisedly, fiction feature debut from French director Alice Diop, who was previously known for documentaries. As I said, the title maybe refers to the location of something metaphysical. A young woman, Rama, is attending the trial of Laurence, who is accused of killing her child. Rama, who is pregnant, is using the trial as part of a writing project that she is doing under the umbrella banner of Medea. And there's a discussion about whether or not people know the story of Medea. I would assume that most people do, but if you don't, it's to do with mothers killing children. Sorry, that does a great disservice to the legend. You know, but okay, fine. And Laurence is a Senegalese immigrant who said that she was working on a thesis and that she had an unhappy relationship with her partner who is older than her, who basically denied her existence, kind of kept her away from the rest of the world, denied his paternity of the child, and acted in a way that was abusive. But crucially, she does not deny any of the key details of the prosecution's case, which is that she took the child to a beach where she either caused it or allowed it to drown. She says that she's not guilty because she was acting under the influence of strange forces, of a darkness that had enveloped her for the period before, leading up to, and then during the life of the child. Here is a clip, as I usually say, we have a rule here about playing clips from movies, even if they're not in the English language. If you don't speak the language, I'll sort of summarize afterwards what's being said in this clip.
Vous nous dites que vos troubles commencent environ un an avant la naissance d'Élise, ce qui correspond à peu près à la conception d'Élise, c'est ça?
Oui, peut-être. C'est possible, je me souviens pas des dates.
Est-ce que vous faites en sorte que personne ne remarque cette grossesse ni ne la voit?
Je me suis comportée comme si je n'étais pas enceinte, pas parce que je voulais pas qu'on le voie.
Une fois enceinte, avez-vous vu un médecin?
Je n'ai pas vu de médecin, je n'ai rien dit à personne.
Comment s'est déroulé l'accouchement?
Lily est née à l'atelier, j'ai accouché seule.
Pourquoi vous ne vous rendez pas à l'hôpital?
Je sais pas, j'étais dans un trou noir. Je sortais pas, je voyais personne. Et puis j'avais peur pour Lily, je voulais la protéger.
La protéger de quoi?
De la malveillance.
So at the end there, Laurence, played by Ghislaine Malanda, says, I wanted to protect her from malicious intent, that she had been surrounded by dark and brooding forces for the period leading up to this. She is watched from the viewing gallery by Kaji Kagame's Rama, who, as I've said, is pregnant and who, as she is speaking, makes these gestures that suggest that she is being repelled, but also it's like somebody struck a tuning chord. She's hearing resonances of things that are striking her in a way that she didn't expect. Now, as you could probably hear from that clip, and that clip is very representative of the film, the script is very, very wordy. It is full of long expositional speeches. It takes place largely in court. And many of these are delivered in unsparingly long takes, focusing singly on the face of the person speaking. So there is a theatrical air again. This is the third time during this show that we've talked about theatre. For me, there is no problem with the theatre of this. The theatre of this, because courts are theatre, court is theatre. We hear from her partner, the older man who denied paternity and kept his relationship a secret. We hear about the accused's own conflicted relationship with her own mother and her claims of sorcery, that somehow magic is involved. And all the way through this, we see this young woman sitting in the audience who's working on a project about Medea, who is pregnant, starting to somehow find that she is becoming the other side of the same coin. It is interesting that when I argued that The Whale is a bad stage play and stagey, that what I'm essentially saying here is that the staginess works in its favour, but I think that's partly to do with the subject. I think it's also to do with the writing. I mean, this is so much better written than The Whale. The performances are just astonishing. You don't believe that you're watching actors playing these roles. What you believe you're watching is something actually... Because even down to the slightly stumbling nature of some of the encounters, you kind of have the feeling that if you just stuck a camera in court and this played out, it would be like this, because court is theatrical. But the most important thing about it is that all the time that you're watching it, all the time that I was watching it, I kept thinking, there's something here, there's something going on that I'm not quite sure what it is, but it's coming up from the ground. And it's not something that's going to be that the law is going to be able to deal with. And I found myself mesmerized by it. I was really quite freaked out at certain points, and I thought it was a really powerful piece of cinema, the likes of which I can't remember seeing recently. Now, I know it's not for everyone. You're making faces that suggest that you liked it too.
Very much so, okay, yeah. And in fact, the sense of it nothing quite like this having been around for a while, it reminded me a bit of Alan Rennie in the way that it was playing with, you know, theatre and cinema and where the two overlap. And you're absolutely right. The court as theatre is so kind of essential to how the film works, and particularly in the way that, because, you know, the writer, she's gone along to this case because she hopes to mine it for her own work. And yet she finds out that the case is somehow becomes the work. It's a really profoundly smart film. And I think in addition to the two performances, which, as you say, are just knock your socks off incredible, the two central performances.
Because you don't think you're watching acting. You think you're watching people being.
But I think part of that is down to this completely pristine digital photography. Like the psychologically searching camera work in this film is really special. And it's something that I think you can only really achieve on digital. EO is like this as well. You know, EO is a film that works very well. Having been digitally photographed, it leans into the strengths of digital photography. Saint Omer, even more so, I think, does this in the way in which it kind of confronts us with these characters and forces us to scrutinize, because the camera is completely non-judgmental in this court setting, which again, you know, it's so kind of intellectually clashy, and it leaves you can't kind of just be psychologically at peace with what you're watching. You're always wrestling with something, whether it's the showdowns in court or whether it's the conversations, you know, in the cafe in which she's talking to the mother and so on. Yes, it's not a tough sit, but it's certainly one for which you have to be intellectually braced, I think.
And in
the same way as you would be for Rennie, though, you know. I mean, and this is a massive compliment.
It's also true that one of the reasons it works so well is that there's no you can't handle the truth. People talk in a very, very measured register. In fact, there is a moment when the partner, when he is asked, "Who do you blame for this?" And his answer is self-incriminatory. And he sort of starts to tremble. And that's pretty much as far as it gets. And all the time there's this thing about, you can feel the courtroom looking at this central character and going, why aren't you being emotional? And there is something about that low register of it which makes you lean in. And it makes you listen to every word, or, you know, read every word on the subtitle. If it's like me, you don't speak the language, and wonder about what's actually going on. And there are moments as well, of course, when because it's a court thing, they say you expect us to talk about black magic. This is a court. This, in fact, at one point he says something like, "This is a court. This isn't a theatre, or this isn't a, you know." He makes a big thing about it. It's a court. And you go, no, but it is. That's the whole point. It is.
And it's the limitations of the earthly realm, or, you know, society, or these kind of bureaucratic institutions which we depend on. to actually kind of come to grips with the fundamentals of human experience and what we can do.
There's a really weird, correct me if I'm wrong about this, there's a weird bit in it in which there's an argument about her saying that she was doing her thesis on, is it Wittgenstein?
Yes. And Cantor Wittgenstein, and it's not, they squabble over which one it is.
And it becomes this incredibly petty argument about, well, I didn't think that she would be doing that because it's not from her culture. And so this, what appears to be a completely petty argument, suddenly becomes it reveals this kind of underlying cultural hegemony. Well, I just imagined that, you know, and there's that underlying kind of racial thing going on, which I thought was really, because at no point does anyone say that's a racist thing, but it implies it.
Mm-hmm. Anyway. That is...
Be interested to know what people think about
it. I know. Please, please go and see this. That's Saint-Omer from Alice Diop. More now from Simon Mayo's conversation with Brendan Fraser and Darren Aronofsky.
Anyone who has teenage children or has had teenage children needs to see Sadie Sink's performance, who manages to embody every furious argument that any parent has ever had. But she's... How horrible is she to you?
Sadie has, first of all, talent that presages her years. And I watch this actress just get a gold star every single day. And I would often get lost in her emerald green eyes and go up on my lines. I'm not just paying you lip service here. She's that good. And I know that the trapping of falling into an angsty teenager trope is what she deftly avoided, because her approach was to see this girl as deeply hurt for having been abandoned by her father, and that manifests itself as very specific rage and brand that she can play that's focused and furious and brilliant.
So where does Charlie get his optimism from? Because he regularly says things like people are amazing, and his daughter can't really cope with the positivity which is coming back from her father. How does Charlie remain in the situation that he is in, the medical condition that you've described? Where does that come from?
I thought about this a lot, and the clearest, simplest answer that I arrive at is that all of his life he would have been derided, made to feel less than, made to feel really, really poorly about himself, and that wouldn't have caused him to collapse in and not have a life. So he made a decision to be quite the opposite, whether it's a gift that he has as a person or a choice that he's made. It's really the only defense that he can have to the world, is to ignore the haters, as it were, and go to the light.
A listener's question here. Seth Mussey says, what role of Brendan's resonated with you, Darren, and what inspired you to cast him, and vice versa? So I imagine which of Darren's films. So
yeah,
you go first.
It was really just spotting Brendan and remembering him and having never considered him over the 10 years because he didn't pop up in any of the casting lists or any of the conversations. And as soon as I saw him, I was like, that's super exciting. And I actually didn't realize it was so close, that my first phone call to you was in January 2020, and then we met in February 2020. So it was really quick. So basically, he showed up as an idea, and then I invited him to come visit me in my office, and a complete gentleman came in who clearly wanted to work, which is always exciting for me as a director. And then we set up a read-through of it, which, like, he, unbeknownst to him, it was kind of a test because we hadn't really seen him do anything like this in a long time. But from line one or two, it was just clear, oh, that's Charlie.
So Brendan, you'll have seen Natalie Portman in Black Swan and Mickey Rourke in The Wrestler. Absolutely. You know what this man gets out of his lead characters.
Absolutely.
Was that inspirational or frightening?
Both films seem based in performances that those characters have to give, the ballerina and the wrestler athlete, and them doing what they do to save their life in some way. And how Darren handles that material stretches all the way back to the early work I saw with Pi and Requiem.
What do we see you in next, Brendan, after this?
Oh, gosh. I think there's a, I have to think about it. I did a comedy called Brothers with Josh Brolin, Peter Dinklage.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Oh, that's exciting.
They played fraternal twins.
Okay. I just, I ran into Peter actually because our kids go to the same school and he was very complimentary, but he didn't mention that you guys are working together.
It's in the bag already. Maybe he forgot.
I don't think he forgot, but anyway.
I had to think about it myself, so maybe.
Yeah.
And what are you working on next, Darren?
Bunch of things, nothing to talk about quite yet.
Okay, but in due course, it will be
unveiled. Definitely.
Anyway, good luck at the Oscars. And
thank you. And at the BAFTAs.
And at the BAFTAs before that. I'm a member of BAFTA. That's terrible.
Yeah,
good luck with the BAFTAs, and then good luck with the Oscars.
Thank you.
Brendan Fraser, Darren Aronofsky, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Simon.
Thank you very much to Brendan Fraser and Darren Aronofsky.
Can I ask you one further thing on the subject of, since we're into take two, so we have a little bit more time, on the subject of the whale. Do you think, I mean, I'm very interested by your Old Testament reading. I think that's, you know, that gives it a depth that I find interesting. Do you think that when it comes to the awards bait thing, that Fraser is at all guilty of, I mean, I'm thinking partly about the way in which he's received his awards, is at all guilty of the give me an award I have suffered for my art?
No, I don't think so. I didn't get that. And I'm very allergic to all that stuff.
Yeah.
The DiCaprio in the Revenant School of Awards Acting. I would much rather, you know, why did he win for that and not Wolf of Wall Street? Just exasperates me. I don't think that's how Fraser is approaching this. And to me, it didn't come across like that on screen.
Okay.
But I know that so many critics have taken issue with this performance on those grounds. So it's very, very obviously it can be read in two.
What are your best Oscar acceptance speeches? Ways. Okay, so you know what do you think is the way to receive an Oscar?
Like Olivia Colman receives an Oscar. Come on, I mean that's about as well as it can be done, right?
My two North Stars are, on the one hand, Sally Field, you like me, you really like me.
Yes.
And on the other hand, Louise Fletcher, when she won for Nurse Ratched, who said, I love this award because it means you really hated me. Because they hated the game. I think that's in a way,
spectrum.
That's it. That's the full spectrum.
Now, I have an email here from Ben, who writes, relatively new listener here and first-time emailer. I always dreamt that my first email to you would be some illuminating addition to a complex discussion.
But
alas, instead,
alas.
I'd like to agree with Mark regarding your conversation about bad English pronunciations.
Okay.
I know I'm shocked too, but I did indeed say agree with Mark. Normally, I find myself chuckling away and nodding with you, Simon, but Mark made a good point. Why is pan au raisin, any worse than the English pronunciation of Vincent van Gogh?
Precisely.
Especially considering that Koch is someone's surname, and therefore it should surely only have one pronunciation.
Mm-hmm.
Well, raisin is, correct if I'm wrong, spelled exactly the same way as the English
raisin.
Having typed out this email, I'm now contemplating whether it was worth my time or indeed yours.
No, it was
but
worth your time.
Please read it out anyway, because I can take it off the bucket list. Keep up the sterling work. Up with sugary pastries and down with secondhand smoke.
It put a spring in my step. The secondhand smoke thing was, you know, somebody said there was a thing in the newspaper that said, bringing cake to work is as dangerous as secondhand. No, it isn't. Grow up. The Van Gogh thing is, because I remember, you know, I went to Holland and I went into the museum and I said, you know, look, tell me, I need to know, is it Van Gogh or Van Gogh? And they went, it's neither of those two things. It's, and then they said this, you know, Van Gogh, in a way, which, sorry, pardon, I've literally never heard it said that way before. And I think if that's the case, then if we're all going to say Van Gogh, then I'm saying pan au raisin, and that's perfectly fine.
Well, on the same burning subject, this from
there's
Matthew.
More.
There's more.
I thought you were keeping your Tinder dry. Okay, on.
Dear pan au raisin and raisin pain.
You even went, pan au raisin.
That's allowed, isn't it? Is that not accurate? Or is that like...
It's very French.
Tu as la raison? That's different.
Do you speak French?
I did French to a higher level in the old Scottish higher exams. And then...
Well, sorry, what does that mean?
So it's kind of A-level level.
But
I had
French.
No reason to cultivate it since then, and it's very much fallen into disrepair. But every year when I'm back at Cannes, it kind of just about rallies and then disappears. Anyway, dear pan au raisin and raisin pain, Mark seemed quite sure that he should pronounce the raisin... More of this. Mark seemed quite sure that you should pronounce the raisin in pan au raisin using an English pronunciation, but say pan in the French manner.
Mm-hmm.
Skip forward to this week's top 10, which contained two Tamil language films.
Yes.
Mark apologized for his pronunciation of the titles in these films. This is someone trying to catch you out
here.
Just wondering that if an apology is required for the potentially bad pronunciation of films, shouldn't this also apply to the potentially bad pronunciation of other things such as widely available pastries? Love the show, Steve. Tinkety tonk and all that jazz.
No. I mean, it's Pano Raisin is now an anglicized thing. Okay, it's like
restaurant,
like yeah, precisely, or an hotel. You know, do you say an hotel or do you say a hotel?
A hotel.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, of course we shouldn't. We should say an hotel. And in fact, if you read, you know, well written literature from some years ago, I am going to say it an hotel. No, you're not. You're going to stay at a hotel, but because we're in England now, or in, you know, Wales or Scotland or Ireland or anywhere where that H would get pronounced. Now I'm going to get emails from all of those places saying, actually, over here we wouldn't, but it's, you know, it's a hotel. There's another one of those which is, there's another one which is really, really like that. Anyway, whatever. Pano Raisin.
Changing the subject. Dear Cordyceps Kermode and Mycelium Mayo, I'm writing to you after watching the flawless third episode of The Last of Us, having been a longtime fan of the video games, both the original and its sequel, finishing my last playthrough of the former just before this show, so it was fresh in my memory. As I continue to watch the show, I'm amazed at how much it offers old fans like myself while remaining accessible to newcomers. I've watched it with people who've never played the games and enjoyed seeing their reactions compared to mine. Neil Druckmann is doing a great job expanding on the world he, Bruce Straley, and the team at Naughty Dog built a decade ago. And Craig Mazin seems like the perfect person to adapt it into TV. They're giving us moments in the show which are either not in the game or expanded from it, like the extended time spent with Sarah, who in the game we're limited to seeing her on the night of the outbreak, and in the most recent episode with Bill and Frank, which plays out very differently in the game. So far, it has been exceptional, with episode 3 the best so far. Massive shout-outs to Nick Offerman, Murray Bartlett, and the makeup team, who made the two of them aging look so natural and seamless. Also, no matter how many times I've played the game, it'll never prepare me for that scene with Sarah, or the last moments of Bill and Frank's story. I could go on, but I'll save some thoughts for an extra take The Last of Us spoiler cast once the show ends, if you have one. Here's to it continuing on this great trajectory. Up with great video game story adaptations, and down with host imprisoning, apocalypse-causing mushrooms. Luke Gorman from Belfast.
On the subject of hats off to, I mean, hats off to Evan Bolter, who, if you remember, was the cinematographer on Chicken and Mum's List, and I remember saying this when Chicken came out, saying, I don't know this cinematographer, but he's really good. And of course, now you go, oh yeah. And it really reminded me of The Good Lady Professor Her indoors watching straight-to-video erotic thrillers going, I don't know who this Wally Pfister guy is, but he's got a career ahead of him, you know. There is something really, really lovely about seeing somebody's work early on and thinking they're really good, and then going, oh yeah, no, there we are, and there it is. Are you watching Last of Us?
I am not.
Because
I've just not got around to it. But okay. I know it's incredibly popular, and it's doing that great thing as well. I mean, this is the issue with binge watching for me, is that there is no conversation kind of springs up around a show like this where everyone's watching the same episode at the same time, week in, week out, that then lures in people like me who weren't necessarily tempted at first. I mean, I think the whole idea of it being a video game adaptation is fascinating because, of course, history tells us these are not normally successful endeavours. But, you know, we've got a remake of, or rather a completely new Silent Hill film coming up soon from the director of the original Silent Hill, which I think was pretty underrated, that was based on the second video game, and also I think a video game remake of the second video game.
Okay. Did you play the video games?
Some of them. I actually really struggle with horror video games because
Did you play them because you have kids or because you were a video game enthusiast?
Oh, a video game enthusiast.
Fine.
Yes.
Okay. Fine.
Although that did slightly fall by the wayside when the kids were younger, but now
it's
coming back. Yeah, I mean, there's horror in video games and horror in film and film adjacent television. To me, are really different. I don't know if you remember the Jurassic Park video game on the Super Nintendo, which was out when so this was when the original Spielberg film was out. There were sequences in that game that are among the scariest experiences in front of a screen I have ever had. And the first part, anyone who played it will know immediately what I'm talking about, is the first person sequences when you go into a facility and you're being stalked by the velociraptors and you have to kind of inch around these corridors and, you know, strafe sideways into rooms to make sure you're not going to have your face clawed off or chewed off. They are so terrifying. And there's something I think about being put into the position of the decision maker. Because, you know, part of what's so delicious about horror is shouting at the screen. This was so much the case with Barbarian. Don't do that, you idiot. What are you doing? And of course, in video games, you are the idiot. And it's the dynamic is completely different. And I really genuinely struggle with it. I tried to play Resident Evil 2, the remake of that, on the PS5 recently. Couldn't do it. Just did not have the stomach for it.
Alien Isolation, it was Isolation, wasn't it?
Yes.
Was again, that, as you say, really properly scary. And in a way, because you are the person making the idiot decision. I mean, the Barbarian thing is, just find another B&B, you know.
It's just, all good.
Look down the street. No, just go somewhere. You know, I'm sure there's a 7, you know, just go somewhere else. There's a Motel 6 somewhere. Don't stay where you're about to go to.
Now, it's time for another round of pretentious moi.
Oh, yes.
But it looks like the production team have put a spin on this week's feature. And this week, I'm the one who has to guess the review that I wrote many years ago from a quote that you, Mark, are going to read out. Please cue the tension, Ben. I've been dreading this ever since we started recording.
So,
oh, dear.
Now, you know that the way this works is that we take out defining names,
yes,
anything that would tell you what the film is, and we replace them. So the replacement names in the section, they've given you a long chunk, incidentally, are Sanjeev Bhaskar, Ben Bailey-Smith, Edith Bowman. Okay, so there are three names, Sanjeev Bhaskar, Ben Bailey-Smith and Edith Bowman, which have been replaced. I also share your anxiety because this, for me, has become almost my least favourite part of the weekly show. So, the quote reads as such. With their clothes on, however, the characters become spectacularly uninteresting, particularly Sanjeev Bhaskar. A self-obsessed drip with a fondness for droning monologues. And Ben Bailey-Smith can't seem to stop himself from popping up, so to speak, not only in groinal close-up, but also in a supporting role as a gallerist called Edith Bowman, and also spiritually in Sanjeev's various ravings about cinema and his stated ambition to make films, and this is the giveaway, full of blood, sperm, and tears.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Okay, I know what this is. It's Gaspar Noé's Love, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And it's weirdly enough, I quoted the same blood, sperm, and tears in my review of it, and that was reading this, because I didn't look it up before, and went, I know what that is. So, tell us about Gaspar Noé's Love.
Well, I'm glad that's the bit of the review you clipped, because I always thought the most interesting part of that film was the rude stuff.
Yeah.
And it was when it tried to be clever that it all fell apart.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know, Gaspar Noé has kind of really rallied for me because his last one, the name of which, what was it called? Vortex.
Which is a lovely film.
Is a terrific film. And he had that Strobe one as well, Lux Aeterna, which was, I mean, desperately experimental, but still very interesting.
I like the fact that you referred to it as that Strobe one.
Climax was such good fun. You know, that was the kind of, love was just such a damp squib. And it's a shame because if there was one person in the world that I wanted to see make 3D pornography, it was Gaspar Noé. And what a letdown, anyway.
Well, well done. How early on in that quote did you get that?
It was the gallerist.
The
line,
gallerist,
yes.
Fine, okay.
But the with their clothes on, however, made me very relieved that we were not doing the paragraph beforehand.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, very, very good. Well done. So you're 1 out of 1 and I am 7 out of 9.
Hooray. Now, one frame back.
Yes.
This is the feature where we look at your recommended films inspired by something we've spoken about this week. And in this case, it's M. Night Shyamalan's Knock at the Cabin. So, shall we have a look at the other Shyamalan films that have been recommended by The Vanguard?
Go ahead.
David says, and I'm inclined to agree with him, The Sixth Sense, which is the obvious and best
choice.
Which
you've already said, it's, you know, you actually said, I'm sorry to say, it is the best.
I know, and it's obvious but true. Some genuinely chilling moments, but ultimately a beautiful character piece with Toni Collette's final scene always bringing me to tears. Ben Green suggests The Village or Unbreakable. For me, though, the best thing he's been involved with is the film adjacent The Servant, which is one of my favourite ever TV series.
I haven't seen it. Have you seen
it? No, I haven't. Okay. Spoon Lamp says an incredible start with The Sixth Sense, and Unbreakable is one of the best superhero movies out there. Signs was okay until the awful Scooby-Doo ending. and I've never been excited by any of his other work, although I did see Split for McAvoy, who was superb in it.
I would say see Glass, see Old, because it's not the film. And, you know, as
and
we've
seen, Knock at the Cabin, because it's going back towards, I think, the tradition of those earlier ones. Ricky Wilkes says The Village. It kept me guessing throughout. Beautiful score,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Mr. Lane Music says, I was very impressed with Split. A superb performance from James McAvoy, whom I hadn't come across much at that point. This film really elevated him to one to watch status. And now this is either Dawn or Down Robinson. My favourite is The Lady in the Water. It's meta M. Night, and I love it. Going out on a limb here. The best is The Sixth Sense.
You are so far out on a limb.
But the best is The Sixth Sense, and Toni Collette elevates it. That scene in the car where she's starting to get it brings me to tears every time. Unbreakable is terrific, and those are my top three.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to say, and I know partly this feels like, oh, that's the smart choice. I do think Unbreakable is brilliant. And I also think Unbreakable is important in his career because it didn't become a huge success, but it kind of gave an indication of what he was attempting to do beyond just, you know, make puzzle thing. I remember there was a little thing going around at the time, you know, if the, what was the phrase they said? If the plot's got a twist, they remember the script. And it was a thing about, you know, that's what, because when people are voting in awards, most of the people who are voting, they're busy, you know, they just go, oh yeah, that had a great twist. Yeah, yeah, fine, do that. I think Unbreakable, because it was the beginning of that series anyway, it was a really brave move. I always liked The Village, and I know that The Village really annoyed some people, because when The Village reveal moment happens, I know people who just went, oh, for heaven's sake. But I always kind of got on with it. There's just something about Unbreakable. The fact that it failed makes it better. You know, it's like you love, so you always say to filmmakers, which film do you like the best? And they invariably choose the one that didn't work because it's the kind of the one that required, you know, the most love and attention. What's your favourite, Shyamalan? I know you said Sixth Sense is the best, but what's your favourite?
Yes, I mean, I still think those two, the first two where he came to prominence are kind of unbeatable. And I think of those two, probably The Sixth Sense. Mm. Although it's been a while since I've seen Unbreakable, so maybe I need to go back and rewatch.
It's really good.
In fact, I don't think I've seen it since it came out.
Oh, okay, fine. No, it's a really good film, and I would advise you to seek it out again. But I always loved, again, I'm going to cite the great Kim Newman. Kim said that the thing about Glass that was one of the best jokes in Glass is all the way through Glass, the film is going, it's pointing at that tower, right? And it's going, and they are going to have the superhero fight on the top of the tower. They're going to have the superhero fight on the top of the tower. There's the tower, the superhero fight. And at the end of the film, they have a punch up in a car park. And it's literally like you go, wow, that's fantastic.
And completely connected to what you said earlier about Shyamalan's strange kind of lack of feel for whether something's going to work or not.
Yeah.
And actually, even when it's slightly off, that is him at his most interesting.
Yeah.
That's absolutely one of those moments.
Yeah, really, it really, really is. And you can imagine somebody in a meeting going, are you going to tell him or shall I? M. Night, this whole thing about punch up in a car park.
Now it's time for Take It or Leave It, You Decide.
Yes.
And this week's installment has been suggested by Ronan Scott and Ruben Dabbs. So from Ronan, hello Mark and Simon.
Hello.
Sorry if I've somehow missed it, but I can't find any reference to the Australian film The Stranger on your podcast. It would help to have some clarity on where you stand on films that have limited theatrical release and are primarily seen on streaming services, as is the case with this film on Netflix. I feel like I've heard you discuss some streaming films, but not others. I'd be really interested to hear Mark's view on a film that has affected me more than any other this year. Mm. I was initially drawn to it by the soundtrack work of Oliver Coates, also the composer for After Sun, and just a great standalone musician, and also I think one of those people who, having noticed him at this early point in his scoring career, will come to be someone you think, glad I saw in the first place.
Absolutely.
But the cinematography, central performances, and approach to the subject matter held my attention. I've watched it numerous times since, and it would be a shame if people were unaware of it. Then we have an email from Ruben Dabbs, who essentially reiterates all the same points as Ronan. He is very keen to hear your take on this film, Mark, and he loves a new show. Hopes you're doing well. Best wishes from Melbourne, Australia.
Okay, well, so here's the interesting thing. So I obviously, as you know, I'm a Cannes don't person, so I wasn't in Cannes. So you saw this in Cannes?
It was last May, and it was part of the Uncertain Regards strand, which is kind of interesting voices from around the world.
It is the strand which is unkindly referred to as the films which the festival regards uncertainly. Which is, so I didn't know anything about this at all until the emails came in and I was asked to watch it for Take It or Leave It. Our approach to stuff that goes straight to streaming is there's more of it than we can deal with. So the reason we're doing Take It or Leave It is you suggest and we will, you know, and we'll try and catch it. I should point out that we didn't review To Leslie when it opened to no fanfare at all on streaming services after having played at Raindance. And now, of course, I mean, I've now seen it because I interviewed Andrea Riseborough during the campaign, but that was one of the things that just slipped under the radar. I mean, I don't, people weren't even sure whether it was available, whether it had been released. So this is an Australian psychological thriller. It is impossible to talk about this without some spoilers. So the first thing I'm going to say is, if you're really interested in seeing this with no spoilers at all, fast forward for about 4 minutes, because even telling you the following thing is a spoiler, okay? The film is based on a nonfiction book called The Sting, The Operation That Caught Daniel Morcombe's Killer. Now, I know nothing about that operation or that story. I asked you before whether you did, and you said you thought it was an Australian story. However, the parents of the victim in that particular case had expressed profound displeasure at the fact that the name of their son was being used to publicize the film and that it was about that case. And the makers of the film said, this is important, The Stranger is a fictionalized account of the undercover police operation that resulted in a successful murder prosecution. Out of our deepest respect for the family, the name of the victim is never mentioned in the film. The film does not depict any details of the murder, nor is the family represented in any way. Instead, it tells of the unknown police professionals who committed years of their lives and their mental and physical health to resolve this case and others like it. Now, going in completely cold, I didn't even know that it was about an undercover agent, because you don't find out that the central character is an undercover agent for a while. I mean, most people going in to watch this would already know, because I presume it says something about it on the synopsis, on the Netflix synopsis. So Joel Edgerton is infiltrating the criminal world and gaining the confidence of a character played by Sean Harris, who was referred to variously as Henry Peter Teague and Peter Morley. The poster seems to be an amalgam of their two faces, and it's that kind of, you know, dark, light, you know, criminal cop thing, which is
where does the boundary lie?
Precisely, right? Yeah. Which is the subject of basically all undercover cop. I used to have a real fondness for undercover cop movies. I was really, you know, I couldn't get enough of them. Cruising was one of my favorite films. I thought it was the great, you know, Al Pacino goes undercover in the S&M heavy leather scene of, you know, in New York, and discovers himself. So that is the central theme here, but the film parcels out its information kind of slowly. And what it's really about is about the mood, the fact that the central character is befriending somebody who he believes may be a, you know, a heinous criminal, but he's having to befriend him and he's having to find common cause with him in order to get him into his confidence. And I think here that there's a not entirely spurious connection with something like Saint-Omer, in which you have two characters apparently on different sides of the law, but it's the frisson of connection that makes the thing work. I did think Oliver Coates' score was fantastic. We've been playing it on Scala. I think Oliver Coates, as you quite rightly say, is one of those people who, in 5 years' time, when everyone is talking about, can we get Oliver Coates to score our film, we're going to feel very pleased with ourselves.
He's worked with, I mean, you'll know this better than I do, but he's worked with Mika Levy and Johnny Greenwood and people like that, hasn't he? I mean, he's part of that. There's a movement there that's going on that's very exciting.
He's part of the, yes, there's a reason why he's, you know, EDM and all. I mean, he's a really, really interesting composer. I thought, I mean, it's directed by Thomas M. Wright, who also wrote the script. It shuffles its time frames quite dexterously. It has a kind of brooding sense of doom and portent, and which I think it carries off well. I do think the performances are good. I thought Joel Edgerton was actually terrific. And I mean, Sean Harris is, when did you last see Sean Harris not be really good? He's like really good in everything. I think if you end up comparing it to, I mean, when I was talking to you about it just before we did this recording, you know, everything gets compared to Snowtown, which is kind of unfair. More recently, Nitram, which is a very different movie. Again, a movie that is inspired by a real case that it does not actually specifically cite, although you know exactly what it's talking about. And that, of course, caused a degree of consternation when it came out. I was drawn into it. I knew nothing about it in advance. I didn't even know that it was, you know, that it was based on a fairly well-known true story. But I thought the performances drew me in, and I thought it was a solid undercover, dark, brooding thriller. I don't think it's more than that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, I would recommend it to anyone who does enjoy Snowtown and Nitram. I think it's very much in that tradition of, you know, punishingly bleak Australian crime stories. Again, yes, I don't think it's quite up there with those two. The thing that really stuck with me about it is Joel Edgerton's relationship with his kid.
Yeah.
And the kind of awful clash between what he's doing as part of his undercover work and having to reconcile that with still being a father. Those scenes I remember being very, like, in a very profoundly sad way, very uncomfortable to watch.
Yes.
And that was the thing that really stuck with me. Also, there's a searching scene towards the end that's really well staged. And, without spoiling, yes, I think if those kind of films, if Snowtown is something that you got a lot out of, and goodness knows, Snowtown, I think, is a complete masterpiece, do see it. But I don't think it's quite on the same level, though there's much to love about it. On the Sean Harris thing, I still can't get over his performance in Spencer as the chef. Declaiming these menus like he's reading Molière. I mean, it is just the most madly, tonally judged, but perfect performance.
Some kind of genius, isn't he?
Yeah, yeah. Now, your suggestions, please, for more great streaming stuff we may have missed, to the normal email address. That's it for Take 2, but we'll be back with you very shortly with questions, schmestions.